What I want to do right now is to define a biblical worldview. So when I say worldview, what comes to mind? What is a worldview? Yes, sir. Okay. So our interpretation of what's going on around us, very good. Okay, what else? What is a worldview? Yes, sir. Okay, and goggles. The goggles, the lens through which we view the culture. So why do you use the word goggles or lens? Why would that be? Okay. Gotcha. This is really nice. Who did that? Very cool. I like that. So nice. I dig it. Okay. So what do you mean by goggles? Okay. So if it's a lens like glasses or goggles, that means everything we see, we're seeing it through our worldview. Good. All right. What else? What is a worldview? Yep.
The way we view the world.
The way we view the world. Yeah, that's just a good breakdown of the term itself. Somebody else? Yes, sir. You used to be on the front row. Did I offend you?
We were late.
Yeah. I'm just kidding. Okay.
They see the world as, well, everybody's fine as long as they follow the rules. Christian worldview, well, nobody's fine because we all sin.
Yeah.
We all make mistakes and we need to turn to God to really be saved. And we all need help.
That's great. Very well said. So the difference between a Christian worldview and an atheistic worldview. Other thoughts on what a worldview is? Other definitions? Okay, let me give you a definition. It comes from James Sire. I already mentioned this book. And I will say, if you want to take this class for college credit, I will have a syllabus in here. A syllabus is just the instructions for if you want to take this as a class. So quick infomercial. You can earn college credit for this class for $250. That's three college credits, 3 hours. If you were not a high school student, that class would cost $1,000. So it's a huge savings. And you're able to take what you do here, and you have to do a little bit more work once you get home, but you actually get college credit for it. We've had students take this class, the worldview analysis class, and transfer it to the University of Kentucky as a philosophy, intro to philosophy course. And so, anyways, so you may consider that. I'm going to bring a syllabus to class, and all you'll have to do is take the syllabus, enjoy the conference, and when you get back home, you go online and sign up. Your parents pay, and you don't have to do anything here this week. But if you want to, you'll not read, if you do the class, you'll not read this book. There's a different book by James Sire called The Universe Next Door, which is a really good book, and you will take that and read the book and do a little more work. That's a great opportunity I would encourage you to check out. Yes, ma'am. That's okay, yes, that is the book we gave out last year. So, all right, any questions about dual enrollment, doing that? I mention that because in both cases, whether you do the class or not, I'm referencing James Sire. If you do the class, you'll read the book by James Sire. But here's his definition of a worldview. And I will read it to you, then I want to break it down and write it on the board. So he defines a worldview as a commitment, and then parentheses, he defines a commitment as, typical philosopher, we define everything. So a commitment, which is a fundamental orientation of the heart. A commitment, a fundamental orientation of the heart that can be expressed as a story or in a set of presuppositions, which are, which can be held consciously or subconsciously, consistently, if I could spit it out, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality. It's a long definition. That provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. So let me read that one more time, and then I'm going to break it down for you. A commitment, a fundamental orientation of the heart that can be expressed as a story or in a set of presuppositions, which can be held consciously. That means you recognize you're holding them, or subconsciously, you don't even understand your own worldview, which is true of a lot of people. It can be held consistently or inconsistently. About the basic constitution of reality that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. That's a mouthful. So let's look at the very first thing he says here. It is a commitment. And he describes a commitment as a fundamental orientation of the heart. What do you think he means by that? A fundamental orientation of the heart. Yes, sir. Okay. Okay, so it deals with how we perceive the world. And why would he tie this to a commitment? Yeah. Yeah, most people don't go through life not evaluating things, just saying, I don't want to have a worldview. People are constantly evaluating truth claims. They're constantly evaluating sermons, messages, commercials, movies. They're interpreting these things. How are they interpreting them? They're interpreting them from a fundamental orientation of their heart. In their heart, they have a certain perspective of the world that they've committed themselves to. The Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 1 that God has revealed His invisible attributes to all people through what has been made, namely this, His eternal power and His divine nature, so that men are without an excuse. He goes on to say that unrighteous men suppress the truth of God in unrighteousness. And so they believe there is no God, and they are actively in their heart committing themselves to a view that there is no God. And James Sire is saying this is a commitment that deals with their heart. They've made a commitment about reality that is a revelation of who they truly are. In Scripture, you have two. I'll give you another reference in the Bible about God revealing Himself. Psalm 19, anybody familiar with that psalm? It says, the heavens declare the glory of God. In Romans 1, Paul says, the heavens declare the wrath of God. So are the heavens sending mixed messages? Or is it based on your perspective? The Psalms are filled with poetry about worshiping God. And for the person who worships God, the heavens declare glory. For the person who doesn't worship God, the heavens declare wrath. What is the difference between Psalm 19 and Romans 1? The fundamental orientation of the heart. So a worldview is at the very beginning, the very offset, the inclination of someone's heart that they've committed themselves to. Okay, the second thing he says here is that it can be expressed in story or a set of presuppositions. I thought I heard someone speaking French. I'm going to go. Was I the only one that heard that? Maybe I'm just hearing things. So it's a story that could be expressed in a set of presuppositions, which could be held consciously, subconsciously, consistently, or inconsistently. What do you think he means by that? So we have a commitment that we can express through a story or a set of presuppositions. I guess this would be helpful. What's a presupposition? Who said that? Something you believe going in. Going into what? Yeah.
Like it's like if you're looking at like an argument between two people, like you go in like having heard one
side. Okay. Gotcha. Good. So it's something you believe going in. So prior to evaluating something, it's something that you, here's an easy way, it's something you presuppose. Right? And so most people's fundamental worldview is it's an expression of a commitment, an affection of their heart. And it's expressed through story and also through the things they presuppose about the world. So presupposition is something that you believe to be true that you cannot prove. It's something that is apart from experience. It's apart from evidence. It's something you presuppose before you even look at evidence or experience. Does that make sense to everybody? So, for example, when Carl Sagan, I quoted him yesterday, he's the atheistic, or was, he's no longer living, the atheistic professor from Harvard University, who was really smart, nice, winsome man, who was on this documentary. And he said, the cosmos is all there, is, or ever was, or ever will be. Can he prove that? No. It's an expression of his commitment. It's an expression of his, a fundamental orientation of his heart that he is expressing through his presupposition about the universe. I know that's a mouthful, but does that make sense? In fact, there's another philosopher, a guy named Thomas Nagel at NYU, New York University, and he wrote a book in 1997 called The Last Word, and he said in it, some of the smartest people I know are religious believers. It's not just that I'm convinced by science that there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. The orientation of his heart, expressed through his presuppositions. And by presuppositions, it's something he presupposes about the universe. He cannot prove it to be true. Okay, now, James Sire says we can hold these things, these presuppositions, consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently. What do you think he means by that?
Christian
postmodernism. Okay. Yeah, they're inconsistent, so they hold, yeah, like the author I mentioned earlier. Do most people realize what presuppositions they hold? Okay, are Christians ever called biased? Have you ever been called biased? Okay, is there anyone who's without a presupposition? And so when you have an atheist say to you, you're so biased, you just interpret everything according to belief in God. You can turn that right back on them. They are so biased, they interpret everything in light of there being no God. In fact, to quote another Harvard professor, Richard Lewontin, published an article a long time ago. He was writing a book review of Carl Sagan, the guy I mentioned earlier, wrote a book called, The Demon-Haunted World or something like that. I forget. But Carl Sagan wrote a book, and Richard Lewontin wrote a review of that book, and he said in his review, he says that we have to commit ourselves to a materialistic view of the universe. Here's what he means by that. The only thing that exists is matter. That's essentially what he means. Okay, if matter is all there is, I want to make sure you guys understand this. If matter is all there is, can there be a God? No, right? If by definition, is God made up of matter and energy, time and space? No, he created all of that. But Richard Lewontin says we have to commit ourselves to a materialistic view of the universe in order that we could do science. And he goes so far as to say we must commit ourselves to a materialistic view of the world so we don't let a divine foot in the door. He's so committed to the fundamental orientation of his heart that he wants to make sure that there is absolutely no possible way that a divine foot can get in the door. It's his presupposition. Most people don't understand their presuppositions as well as Richard Lewontin did. Most people are operating off a fundamental orientation of their heart that they express through presuppositions, but most of them don't fully understand their presuppositions. So they'll say things like this. They will say that Christians are biased. Now, are there biased Christians? Yes. But usually what they mean is you're biased because you believe in God. But here's the truth. They are biased by not believing in God. What we're really saying is not bias. What we're really saying is something we've presupposed about the universe. So presuppositions can be held consciously. We can know them. We could hold them subconsciously. We may not even realize them. We could be consistent with them, or we could be inconsistent. Now, the next thing he says we hold them about the basic their beliefs we hold about the basic constitution of reality. Okay, and I know some of these things read like just a philosophy textbook, so let me try and further explain it if I can. Okay, what is the basic, what constitutes reality? And don't answer just yet. I want you to think about it. I mentioned the early Greek philosophers, some of them who said, what constitutes basic reality is fire. Fire. That's what reality is, made up of fire. Or earth, or wind, or water. Those were the four elements that they thought. Different people thought. Some thought it was all four. Some thought it was one. Some thought it was multiple things. Finally, someone came along and said, no, reality cannot be a plurality of all these different things. Reality has to be made of one thing. There should be one thing that describes all of reality. And they said, so we've talked about four things, earth, wind, fire, and water. There must be a fifth thing that describes all of reality, and they call it the quintessence. Have you ever heard someone use the term, he's a quintessential leader? Do we really mean that he's like number five? It comes from Greek philosophy. I feel like the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you know, everything comes from, give me a word, any word. And I'll show you the root meaning of that word is Greek. Philosophy has a lot of things that we use every day and don't even think about. They said we need a fifth essence that describes everything. So you have four essences, that's not enough. We need one thing that describes everything. And so they said it's the quintessence. If someone has quintuplets, they have how many babies? A lot. Five. So the quintessence was the one thing. What's the one thing that describes all of reality? And when someone talks about their worldview, they're at some point going to hit on what they believe reality is made up of. In fact, James Sire, and I'll give you his questions when we get to it, but the very first question of analyzing any worldview is this: what is your view of ultimate reality? What is ultimate reality? For Carl Sagan, it was the cosmos. For the Christian, it's the triune God. What is ultimate reality? But here's the thing. And man, I want you to catch this. I know it's after lunch and some of you have that glazed over look. Where you start will determine where you finish. Where you start will determine where you finish. Every path has a predetermined destination. So if I get on a road that leads to Cincinnati, I can't expect to get to Nashville. I mean, okay, from here. I could be north of Cincinnati and that road would take me to Nashville. But here's my point. Every path has a predetermined destination. So let's take it out of the world of worldviews for a moment. Some of you and some of us, we've all experienced this, will say, this is the kind of life I want to have, and get on a road that leads that way. Have you ever done that? I want to be this kind of person, and I live this kind of way. Every path has a predetermined destination. It's going to lead you somewhere. So the important thing is to be on the right road leading towards the destination you want to arrive at. If you begin with the basic constitution of reality is eternal, impersonal, non-rational matter, that is going to lead to certain consequences whether you like them or not. Whether you want to be consistent with them or not, whether you want to recognize them or not, where you begin will determine where you finish. Now, I saw a hand up earlier. Yes, sir.
I need to use the restroom.
Oh, well, anytime you need to use the restroom, feel free to head on back, and it's right out here in the hallway. Yeah. So for future reference, you guys, I know it's right after lunch, so you're not going to... You will not interrupt me that much. I used to preach in a coffee shop that stayed open for business, which was a lot of fun. And so I rarely get to, I distract myself more than other people distract me. So this is something we hold about the basic constitution of reality. The most fundamental worldview question every person asks is there a God or is there not a God? That is the most fundamental question. Now you could say, well, they believe in several gods, but that would still be an ultimate belief that there's something other than matter or nature. There are some people who take matter, the stuff that makes up the universe, and they will deify it. What do you think that word deify means? Make it a god. They'll glorify it. And so there are certain worldviews that say that the earth is really God, and everything's a part of God. And so that's a basic commitment about the constitution of reality. And if that's where you start, it will determine where you finish. And we're going to look at that as we go along. So, and I really meant that to be number four. But just leave it at three. I'll try not to be confusing here. So the fourth thing that I'll put on our list is it provides a foundation for life. Foundation. So it's a commitment. It can be expressed in a story or presuppositions. It's something that we hold about the basic constitution of reality. And all of these things provide a foundation for how we live. They provide a foundation for how we live. And I want to illustrate this, and some of you have taken this session more than once, so there will be some overlap. But there's a book by a philosophy professor from Duke University. Any Duke fans in the house? We have a Duke fan. Any UK fans in the house? Okay, you know where to find the Duke fan now. So, so the guy's name's Alex Rosenberg. And he wrote a book called The Atheist's Guide to Reality. Have some of you heard me talk about this book if you've been in here before? And for some of you leaders, that would be a good book to pick up. And the reason it's a good book to pick up, he's an atheist, and he basically just says, if atheism is true, if all that exists, to go back to this part here, the basic constitution of reality, if all that exists is the physical world, what does that mean for life? And so the big title is The Atheist's Guide to Reality. The subtitle is Living Life Without Illusions. I may be messing up the title just a bit, but something like that. Living Life Without Illusions. And here's what he says. If you start with eternal, impersonal, non-rational matter. He doesn't say it quite like that, but essentially, if the physical world is all there is, what does that mean for the life we live every day? How should we view reality? And here's what he says. He says the idea that you are a person. Are you a person? Okay. Okay. Raise your hand if you're not a person. I'm just kidding. Don't. Some of you would do that. He says the idea that you're a person is false. The idea that you're a person is false. There's no person in there. Okay, you're a body that has certain chemical reactions and certain evolutionary instincts, but the idea that you're a person that's somehow more than that is false. So personhood is not true. It's an illusion. And it's an illusion that evolution has led us to accept because it helps further our survival. So if we think that we have true personhood, that has some survival benefit to it, and that's why evolution has allowed us to keep it so long. The second thing he says, how many of you have ever thought about something? Okay, everybody raise your hand because you're thinking about that question right now, right? Okay, he says the idea that you're ever about anything is false. It's false. It's an illusion. And he says, you know, for example, this is in-depth philosophical stuff right here. Is this marker about anything? Is it thinking about anything? Okay. Am I thinking about this marker? Probably. I'm holding it and touching it. So I'm a person, but at the same time, I'm a person who's about a marker, right? I could think about a marker. I could close my eyes and think about Paris, right? I'm not there, physically there, but I'm about Paris. I've never been to Paris. I'd like to go to Paris. But I could think about it, right? He says that's false. It's false. Just like a rock or just like the marker, you really can't be about something else. So that's false. That's an illusion we have to get rid of. It's a trick that our mind plays on us. We can't be about other things. Okay, another thing he says we have to get rid of is the idea that we can make decisions. He says that's an illusion. He says we can make no decisions. Neuroscientists can look at your brain, and we'll just for sake of example say, I make the decision, I'm going to pick up the marker. Pick up the marker. Okay, there's a part of my brain that will light up that is affected, they think, by the decision-making part of the brain. Not a neuroscientist, so this is like, some of you would explain it much better than I would. But a part of my brain that will light up that is supposedly the part of the brain that tells you that would have activity in making decisions. There's another part that controls motor function that would actually move my arm after the decision's made. Does that make sense? So one part of the brain lights up, bink, the idea to do something. The other part lights up, bink, when your motor activity starts and you grab it. Which would light up first? The part that makes the decision or the part that controls the activity? Which part should light up first? It should, but it doesn't. There's actually a split difference that the part of your brain that controls motor function will light up before the part of your brain that controls the decision. Now, so they think. I think there's some real problems with this. But here's what he says. He says your brain's telling you what to do. Your brain does what it wants to do, and it allows you the illusion of thinking you have some control over it. So he says we have no control over our actions. Yes, sir. Well, what would Alex Rosenberg believe about ultimate reality? It's just matter. So how could we be anything substantively, in terms of our substance, different than that? We can't be. Where you start, it's Coke, yeah. Where you start is where you finish. And Alex Rosenberg's just saying, if we really start here, then we need to be more consistent with how we view reality. Yes, sir. Okay, that's a great point. So he brought up morality. So here's what Alex Rosenberg says in his book. He says, and this would be a good note to write down just to think about these things. He says, moral distinctions are an illusion. Moral distinctions are an illusion. Now, here's what a moral distinction is, because that probably doesn't sound that big of a deal to you. Moral distinctions are an illusion. Okay. So a man who goes out, or for example, the two teenage girls who called their friend over and stabbed her to death a couple weeks ago. Did you guys see that in the news? Somewhere in the Northeast, I believe. They called her friend over and they staged the whole thing to get their friend to come over so they could kill her. And they stabbed her to death. Okay, that action. Now take those same two girls and say that they, on another day, they go down and they serve in a soup kitchen and they serve hungry people. Alex Rosenberg says to try and make a distinction between stabbing their friend to death and serving in the soup kitchen, that there's no moral distinction. That's an illusion. It's an illusion. There's no such thing as moral distinction. Richard Dawkins, who's a really well-known atheist writer, says in an article that he published in the late 90s, and I think the title of the article is The Faulty Car, something like that. And it's published on a website that's like, it's the website something like Big Dangerous Ideas. And it's people who basically take a big idea that they think is probably true, that would be kind of a dangerous idea if it is indeed true. And he says, imagine someone driving down the street and their car malfunctions. And they get out of their car and they take out a baseball bat and they begin to lecture their car. How dare you do this to me? You know, you failed me so many times. And they take their baseball bat and they begin to beat their car. They're just going to town on it. You know, you will never do this to me again. He says that would be ridiculous. And he says, and in the same way, to punish people for doing certain things is completely silly. There should be no such thing as moral retribution. There should be no such thing as punishment. We just have faulty cars like we have faulty people like we have faulty cars. So the idea of moral punishment is wrong. That makes sense? So this is moral distinction is an illusion. Here's my problem with it. Okay, the only problem with this book is that it's completely false. And here's what I mean by that. Do we live as though we are people who think about things, who make decisions, who make moral distinctions? In fact, not only do we live as those, do those seem to make up pretty much what it means to live and move and have our being? So either, here's what you have to do. Please see this. You either have to reject what it means to be human, what it means to be about, to have personality, to have moral distinctions, to make decisions. You either reject those things as illusions or you reject your starting point as false. Does that make sense? He begins his book with this statement. physics fixes the facts. That's his thesis. And for those of you who don't know what a thesis statement is, you'll learn in time. Okay, you're going to have to write thesis statements, thesis papers. Thesis is just the point of what you're trying, the point you're trying to prove. So the point of his book is that physics fixes the facts. What do you think that means? Yes, sir. Yeah, so science, so physical science about the physical world is what gives us facts. Yes, sir. Yeah. That if there's no right and wrong, then we don't have what? Yeah. Yeah, now that doesn't mean that atheists are immoral people. Please hear me. I know some atheists that would put a lot of Baptist preachers to shame who are very loving, very moral people. But do their morals line up with their worldview commitments? And what you're saying seems to be no, and I would agree with you. Yes, sir. Far back. What's that? So, every explanation, we live in a physical universe. Every explanation we have has to be physical. If it doesn't have a physical explanation, it's an illusion. So the idea that we make decisions, and let me just say, I gave you the brain example. If there's a immaterial part of us, a soul, that is actually making the decisions, then there's no way to track what happens first, right? I mean, in terms of different parts of the brain operating, there's an immaterial part of us that's actually making decisions. But in terms of what you said, yeah, some people would say we have to get rid of superstition and religion and only deal with scientific physical evidence and physical things we could test physically. Here's the problem with this. It's false. Okay. I'm joking because that's being really dismissive. It is false. Here's why it's false. Did physics teach us this? Is this a truth we learn through physics? Is this a truth we learn through science? By its own definition, it's false. Yes, sir. Okay. I think we're going to touch on that. We're eventually going to get there, so hold that. You're getting ahead of us. So one more quick question. Yeah, you're on the heading in the right direction. Let me word it. I'll give you another quote that says the same thing. This comes from a British philosopher who's now dead named Bertrand Russell. And he said, what science cannot teach us, man cannot know. What science cannot teach us, man cannot know. Okay, here's the problem with that. Okay, this is what is called a recoil argument. It's using the weight of an argument against itself. It's also called a judo flip. Has anybody ever taken judo? Judo lessons? Okay, a little bit. So judo, and I've never taken judo, but from my understanding of judo, it's learning to use your opponent's energy and motion against them. And so a judo flip is taking an argument and applying it to itself. And so, for example, in the previous one, physics fixes the facts. If you applied its argument against itself, if you recoiled it against itself, if you flipped it, you would have to say, did physics teach us this? And the answer is no. Does that make sense? I know it's after lunch, but this is really cool. Okay. Did he discover this through a telescope or under a microscope? Okay. He thought about it. In fact, he wrote a book they seem to think a lot about to try and change people's minds, which he says they can't do. Right? I mean, the whole project is a contradiction. So if we did a judo flip, we'd have to say, physics didn't teach us this. Therefore, by its own definition, it is. Is it true or false based on its own definition? It's false because this isn't a fact. How do we know it's not a fact? Physics didn't teach us it. You see what we did there? Okay. Yes, ma'am. What's that? Yeah. He would say a fact would only be something that we can learn through studying the physical world using physical science. And so things that we might feel. Do you feel like you make decisions? You just answer me. Did you decide to answer me? But see, you just feel like you did. The science would tell us you really didn't have any choice in the matter. So physics just fixed the fact. You feel like you're making a decision, but the science tells us you're really not. And that's what he means. Physics, science is fixing your feeling, letting you know your feelings are wrong. The fact is you don't make decisions. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. So I have a really cool story to tell you about a young lady who became a Christian after growing up an atheist, and it deals with that question. Let me ask you this. What science cannot teach us, man cannot know. That sounds really noble. Did science teach us this? Did Bertrand Russell discover that under a microscope or through a telescope? Do you guys see where I'm going with that? Okay, so if we can only know things about science, then can we know this? No, we can't. And so in other words, if science cannot teach us this, then we cannot know it. Therefore, we don't know if this is true or not by its own definition. Now, hopefully that'll sink into some of you guys. Science didn't teach him that. Philosophy did. Another example I like to share is, you know the scientist who's in a wheelchair? He uses the electronic voice. Stephen Hawking. Who's a brilliant man with an awful disease. Is it Lou Gehrig's disease? Is that what it is? I'm not sure. I forget. But he's lost all control of his body and even his voice. He published a book, a couple years ago, The Grand Design. And the purpose of the book, The Grand Design, is to prove that there is no grand design and no grand designer. And so he says in the opening pages of the book, let's see, he says this. Philosophy is dead. Okay? So what do you think he means by that? Before we do worldview interpretation of it, what do you think he means? Tim, you were a philosophy guy. What do you think he means?
He thinks that the sciences have replaced our need for philosophy.
Yeah.
Religion.
Yeah. So kind of what Rosenberg said and what Russell said, science is the only way to know truth. Okay? Did he discover this under a microscope or through a telescope? Is this a scientific statement or a philosophical statement? Yeah, and so this is, and it's not like to where you can flip every book open and find the one thing and go, aha, you know. But this is the kind of thing that some people will leave Christianity for without recognizing how inherently self-contradictory it is. That is at its root a contradiction. This is a philosophical statement. It's also foundational to what he tries to do in his whole book. Yes, ma'am.
What if people include logic or rationality in science?
Yeah. Yeah, they would include the laws of logic in the same way that they would include other laws about the universe. But the question is, can they explain them based on their basic worldview commitments about what constitutes reality? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Philosophy is dead, then why do we keep trying to figure out
Yeah, so philosophy is dead. Why does it seem to stick around so much? We would just have to recognize it's something we need to give up. We need to give up moral distinctions. We need to give up free will. We need to give up the idea that you're a person. It's just something we need to move past. So, all right. I want to come back to this for one more moment. This is what a worldview is. It's an orientation of your heart that's expressed through presuppositions, things that you presuppose about the universe. It's something that you hold either consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality. Is all reality matter or is there a God? And it provides a foundation for your life. I don't want atheists to live like Alex Rosenberg says they should live. I don't want them to. I hope, in fact, I have atheist friends who we've read Alex Rosenberg's book together. In fact, I just finished it recently with a friend. We read it together and I talk to him about it. The reason I want to talk to him about it is not because I want them to live without moral distinctions. I don't want to live next to Alex Rosenberg if he really lives that way. Does that make sense? I don't want somebody living next to me who believes that moral distinctions are an illusion. I don't want to live next to him. He doesn't live that way, though. He calls religion evil. How can religion be evil if there's if moral distinctions are an illusion? So I read the book with him simply to say, your whole life is pointing the opposite direction. Everything about the human experience is pointing upward. Everything. Everything about the human experience is pointing upward. Here's a good thing to write down. I used to laugh. My mentor will say that a lot. You got to write this down. And I used to laugh at him, and here I am doing it. All of reality is the believer's ally in sharing the gospel. All of reality is the believer's ally in sharing the gospel. And here's what I mean by that. Alex Rosenberg says we have to give up moral distinctions, and we have to give up personhood and aboutness. We have to give up the ability to make decisions. That's what it means to be human. And I want to say, no, it's the opposite. We need to give up a materialistic conception that all that exists is matter. That's what we need to give up, because the human experience is pointing upward. There's a story, Jennifer Fulweiler. She has published a book called Something Other Than God. It's a pretty big book. It's about her story. She grew up as an atheist. Her dad used to read her Carl Sagan, the guy I quoted earlier, and The Demon-Haunted Universe. That's the book that I was thinking of earlier. Her dad used to read her Carl Sagan when she was a little girl. As a young girl, her dad would sit in her bed and read her Carl Sagan. And a loving father, and just thought this was true about reality, and wanted to teach his daughter. And she grew up, no religious background at all. I mean, she grew up straight, secular, atheist. And she, as she got older, she went to college, she met a young man, they fell in love, and they had their first child. This is actually on YouTube. I'd normally play the video about how my laptop hooked up. So I'll just tell you the story. It's a lot more powerful to see it from her. She says she was sitting in her hospital bed holding her baby. Nobody else was in the room, and she started reflecting on this experience in light of her understanding of reality. She's an atheist. She believed everything I've showed earlier. Physics fixes the facts. What science cannot teach us, man cannot know. The idea that philosophy is dead. The only thing that matters is scientific truth. She believed all that. So she's sitting in this bed holding this newborn baby. And she said she came to realize that what she thought she was experiencing as love was only chemical reactions in her brain and evolutionary instincts to spread her genes. The same kind of chemical reaction if I shook a bottle of Coke, just chemical reactions. And she said, sitting there in the hospital bed, I knew that was a lie. That was not true. So what she gave up was not what it means to be human. She gave up her basic understanding of reality. And she began to explore whether or not her fundamental orientation of her heart, expressed through her presuppositions, what she presupposed about the universe, that didn't seem to line up with her sitting in a hospital bed loving this child. So she went to her husband, who grew up Catholic, and she said, I think atheism is false. What am I going to do? And he said, well, you could study all the religions of the world, or you could begin with Christianity, because Christianity makes the unique claim that the Creator visited His creation. And if that actually happened, it should be relatively easy to see if there's good proof for it, or if there's not. You should be able to falsify it, is the exact words he used with her. So she set out to see whether or not there was good reason to believe the Creator visited his creation. And in the end, she came to believe in Jesus Christ, in God, and in Jesus Christ. And now she's a Christian apologist. And so I tell that story because I love the fact she was not willing to give up what it means to be human, but instead to give up a basic orientation of reality that would lead to undermining this experience she had with her child. I've said a lot. Where you start will determine where you finish. Most people don't live as consistently with their worldview. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful that most people aren't running around saying there are no moral distinctions. But the gospel actually explains what it means to be human. What the Bible says about the universe is exactly what we find. We find moral outrage. We find categories of evil and good. We find people who long to know God. It seems like the Bible has a pretty good insight into what it means to be human. Let me close with this. C.S. Lewis wrote years ago the Screwtape Letters. Has anybody read those? It is to this day considered to be one of the most insightful experiences in studying the human experience. Even people who aren't believers will read it because it seems to be a really good insight into what it means to be human. Why would the Screwtape Letters have a good insight on the human experience? Because C.S. Lewis was writing from a Christian worldview, and he was explaining from a Christian worldview what temptation and death and love looks like. A Christian view of reality matches hand in glove with what we experience every day. All right, we don't have time for questions. You guys are headed to your next thing. So thank you for your time. I will see you again tomorrow. Have a good day.